Jim still continues that ministry today in his role as a chaplain for Gift Grand Rapids. Reverend Lucas is now ordained in the United Church of Christ. He's a board-certified chaplain with the Association of Professional Chaplains. He works as a staff chaplain at Spectrum Health, primarily at the Blodgett campus. Tonight's conversation is entitled 20 Years Later, and it's Jim's reflection. He was removed from having credentials with the Christian Reformed Church 20 years ago this past May. And he's going to reflect on what led up to that, the events surrounding what happened in 1998, and his reflections, what's happened since then, both personally for him and the broader community. Following Jim's conversation, we're going to invite a group of panelists up here to talk with us about where they see this conversation going forward. So, without further ado, I'd like to give a round of applause for Reverend Jim Lucas.
Thank you very much and good evening. As I look out on all of you, I find myself thinking, you are my people. Even though... oh... I wasn't expecting that. Even though I am currently not a member of the Christian Reformed Church, I continue to love the CRC. So I am grateful to All One Body for organizing this event. I am grateful to Sherman Street Church for hosting us, and I'm grateful to all of you for being here. I feel truly honored. After I wrote my first draft of my presentation, I realized that I have far more to say than I have time for. So today I'm launching a blog in which I'm going to present blog postings over the course of the next few months that will be an expanded version of what I'm saying tonight. And if you'd like to follow it and spread it to your family and friends, the address is revjimlucas.com. Again, the address is revjimlucas.com. And by the way, the transcript of my presentation tonight is already on the blog, down in the speeches section, way down at the bottom. I would also like to point out that even though mostly what I'm going to be doing tonight is reflecting on the past, presenting stories and insights from years ago, I'm doing so really with an eye to the future. And I genuinely want my remarks to provide inspiration and insights that will help us all build a better church in the future. So here we go. Part one, before 20 years ago. I grew up in the suburbs of Grand Rapids in Wyoming near the border of Granville in a healthy, happy, faith-filled home. Our family was Christian Reformed and had deep roots in the CRC. In fact, my Lucas ancestors immigrated to West Michigan in the mid-1800s and became founding members of the first Christian Reformed Church in North America, the Graafschap CRC, which is on the outskirts of Holland. My mom immigrated to Michigan in 1948 with her parents and brothers, and they had been devoted members of the CRC's counterpart in the Netherlands. When my parents got married, there was no question about what church they would attend. Of course, it would be the closest CRC. I was my parents' first surviving child, and within 6 years, my two sisters and brother arrived. My mom and dad were kind, generous, and self-sacrificing. They took us to church twice every Sunday and also sent us to Sunday school, catechism, and Christian day schools. I was a really good kid. I excelled in my studies and graduated second from the top of my class at Calvin Christian High. My faith was always important to me, too, and during high school, I became excited about following Jesus. I made profession of faith in church when I was 16. I was active in prayer meetings and Bible studies. I was elected president of the church's high school youth group, and I started thinking about becoming a pastor. So it seemed natural that after studying Calvin College, I soon joined the pre-seminary program. It was early in my time at Calvin College, however, that I started becoming honest with myself about something that I'd been trying to run away from, and that is that I felt romantically attracted to other guys. I experienced this realization as deeply troubling. I literally thought it was the worst possible thing that could be true of me, because that was the perspective that I had learned from the entire culture in which I grew up. What was I going to do? For years, I didn't dare tell anyone what I was feeling for fear of being scorned and rejected. I felt ashamed and isolated. All I could do was pray. Pray continually that God would heal me of this terrible affliction. The more I prayed, however, the more I noticed the good-looking guys on campus. I'm glad some of you could laugh at that. And I can laugh at it now, too, but I wasn't laughing at it back then. I actually grew very depressed, anxious and depressed. By my third year at Calvin, I was growing concerned about my suicidal thoughts, and so I started taking some steps to reach out to others for support. I joined a new faith-based community, which had a big emphasis on people being open and honest with each other, and it was there that I began to tell people about what I was feeling. This community eventually formed a church called Christ's Community, Christian Reformed Church. And the people of Christ's Community responded to me with love and acceptance, for which I still am deeply grateful. As far as I could tell, however, they all held the traditional view that gay people are sick. And so I continue to hold this view as well. The thought never occurred to me that there might be another way to look at the issue. Until 1978. I had attended Calvin for 3 years and then took 3 years off, mostly because I was an emotional wreck and couldn't make sense out of being gay and being a pastor. By the end of those 3 years, however, I went back to Calvin because I once again became convinced that God was calling me to the ministry, and I believed that somehow God would make it all work out. So I returned to Calvin for my senior year. That fall, I noticed posters around campus advertising a lecture entitled Homosexuality, Homophobia, and Healing. I attended, and for the first time in my life, heard someone who was a Christian professor and author, speak about gay people in ways that were thoughtful and compassionate. For example, the speaker reported that the psychological profession had taken homosexuality off its list of mental disorders in 1973. I hadn't known that. And what was most shocking to me, she reported that there were sincere Christian scholars who were arriving at the conclusion that the church had been interpreting the Bible incorrectly with regard to people who are gay, and that the church should provide a place for faithful, loving, committed life partnerships of gay couples. This speech shook my world. I had never heard any such thing before, or even considered it possible. As the shock subsided, I found that I was experiencing a mixture of skepticism and hope. On the one hand, I had never heard such a message before, and by nature, I am very cautious and very respectful of the teachings of the church. On the other hand, I found the message incredibly life-giving. I felt a tiny beginning sense of relief from my anxiety and depression. And I thought, maybe I don't have to hate myself after all. Maybe there is a place for me in the church and in the world. The next fall, in 1979, I began my studies at Calvin Seminary. Seminary turned out to be a time of tremendous growth for me, both personally and educationally. By the time I graduated, I had come to peace with myself and with God, and I felt ready to begin my career as a pastor. So what happened in seminary that was so transformative? First, I continued to be active in the households and Church of Christ's Community, and the church elected me as a deacon and then as an elder, with most of the members knowing that I'm gay. That helped me feel that there really was a place for me in the Christian community. Second, I started meeting other people who were gay. I had been afraid to do so because I had learned that gay people were supposedly strange, disgusting, perverse, weird. I just thought I was an exception. But when I actually started meeting other gay people, I was surprised to discover that they were just normal people. If anything, the people I met were unusually nice. I started feeling better about myself, thinking, hey, I'm a part of a group of really cool people. Third, I went to a psychologist for therapy. Early in seminary, I was still really anxious and depressed. And I told my counselor that my goal was simply to be happy again. In my mind, however, I started therapy thinking that I was feeling miserable because, well, that just came with the territory of being gay. And I hoped that I would find a way out of being gay. I thought that maybe my therapist would help me unlock some deep, dark secret from my past that would explain why I was gay. However, my counselor led me through some really in-depth therapy, and what I discovered was that I was miserable not because it was an inherent part of being gay, but because I had swallowed the message of our society that gay people are sick and that gay relationships are sinful. This message, I realized, was poison to my soul. So what was I going to do? Well, what do you do when you discover that you have been inadvertently swallowing poison? You look for antidotes to the poison you have already swallowed, and then you do what you can to stop swallowing the poison that you're swallowing. And that is what my therapist helped me do. I learned ways to let go of the message that gay people are sick and that gay relationships are sinful. I came to believe that God loves me just as I am, that I too am created in the image of God, that I too am a beloved child of God, and that God would be pleased for me to have a life partner. And so over the course of my months and years of therapy, I came to peace with myself and with God. The anxiety faded away and the depression faded away about 90%. And I will tell you about the remaining 10% in a bit. I sometimes summarize my therapy by saying, I came to believe that it's okay simply to be who I am. Now, why did it take all that hard inner work, all those years of therapy, to come to believe something so simple and obvious? And the reason is that I was immersed in a culture that said in a myriad of ways, every day of my life, that it was fundamentally not okay to be who I am. You might be wondering, what kept me going through those years of depression and anxiety and therapy? Well, my beacon of hope was Jesus' promise in John 10, verse 10, I came that they might have life and have it abundantly. I knew that I was not experiencing that abundant life. I was miserable. But I held on to the hope that someday Jesus would fulfill in me that promise of abundant life. It really was that hope, that assurance of life that kept me going. And that brings me to a fourth seminary experience that played a crucial role in my transformation. In seminary, I learned the tools for biblical study and theological reflection, and I applied these tools in my exploration of how to make biblical and theological sense out of being gay. Fortunately, a number of new books and articles were being published at the time, and I read everything I could get my hands on, and these books were very helpful in my research. I summarized what I learned in my seminary research paper on the pastoral care of gay people in the Christian community. And here are just a few insights from that paper. I noted, for example, that when we read and study the Bible, we are always interpreting it. And since we human beings are limited and flawed, we sometimes interpret the Bible poorly. So we should always be humble and open to the Holy Spirit showing us a better way to interpret the Bible. I also pointed out that biblical scholars provide us with basic principles of biblical interpretation. For example, we always need to understand particular passages of the Bible in their context within the Bible itself, and their context within history. With these foundations, I study the Bible as it pertains to those who are gay, and this is what I found, and this is a very, very brief summary. read my blog. I'll expand a bit more. Plus, I have some books already there, some of my favorite books that also address the scripture passages really quite well. Well, I noticed that the particular passages that the church has traditionally used to condemn gay people and gay relationships really are not talking about what we are talking about today. Those passages are not talking about faithful, loving, mutual marriages between two men or two women. Rather, they are condemning relationships that are exploitative. So if the Bible is not condemning gay couples as we know them today, then we need to look at overarching biblical principles for relationships, such as love and faithfulness. Are gay couples capable of love and faithfulness? Absolutely. We have countless examples. Second, we need to look at some wider biblical themes that might provide insight into how we are to respond to those who are gay. For example, Jesus taught that we should consider the lived results of particular teachings. In Matthew 7, in the context of a conversation about how to distinguish true prophets from false prophets, Jesus explains, "By their fruit you will recognize them. Every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit." Well, what might good fruit look like? Well, again, we turn to the Bible and we find all kinds of insights. I found a story in Luke 6 to be especially helpful because Jesus gives an example about how to interpret a scripture. When the religious leaders stand ready to accuse Jesus of breaking the Sabbath law by healing somebody on the Sabbath, Jesus responds, "Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath? To save life or destroy it?" He goes on, of course, to answer his own question by healing the man. To apply Jesus' question, then, we simply need to ask, what does the most good? What is life-giving for people? And specifically, what is life-giving for gay people, their families, for Christian communities, and for society as a whole? What draws us closest to God? What engenders peace, health, harmony, and wholeness within ourselves and in our relationships to God, other people, and the whole creation? What causes people and communities to thrive? To use a Hebrew word found often in the Bible, what nurtures shalom? As I consider the experience of gay people in light of Jesus' teaching, I became convinced that the only way the church could have effective, life-giving ministry with gay people would be to affirm faithful, loving, committed life partnerships for those who are gay. And I spelled out some specific ways to provide such ministry in my paper. Believe it or not, the professor who graded my paper gave me an A. More significantly, my work on this paper helped me resolve my own biblical and theological struggles that I had previously had related to being gay. Well, I finally graduated from Calvin Seminary in May of 1985, was called to be pastor of Christ Community CRC that summer, and was ordained to the CRC ministry in that congregation in the fall. During my 4 years as pastor of the church, I told many individuals in the congregation about my being gay. Some, many had already previously known, but others found, you know, I told. But I never spoke publicly about it. After the church disbanded in 1989, I had to figure out what I was going to do next. I found myself depressed again and physically ill, really ill. So I returned to my therapist. He helped me see that part of the reason for my returning depression and illness was that in most settings, I was still hiding the fact that I'm gay, which for me was a way of agreeing with the assessment of the church and society that gay people are sick and disgusting by virtue of being gay and therefore should hide. I was still swallowing poison. My therapist helped me see that I had one more step to take in my journey toward wholeness. I needed to stop hiding completely. So with my therapist's gentle guidance, I made a decision in his presence that if any church would consider me in the future for a church staff position, I would tell that church up front about my being gay. It felt like a safe decision in the moment because it had been a few months since any church had expressed any interest in interviewing me. I thought, oh, nobody wants me anyway. But then 2 weeks later, I got a call from a church search committee inviting me to a weekend of interviews and preaching as the church considered me for a new youth pastor position. In my interview with the two pastors already on staff, I told them about my being gay, and so I fulfilled my commitment to myself and to God and to my therapist. The two pastors told me that they would be happy to work with me, but they said, don't tell the search committee. And for a number of reasons, I decided to follow their advice. A few days later, I received a phone call from the search committee contact person saying, congratulations, Jim, the search committee has unanimously recommended you for the position. They said, it's just a formality from here on out, so you can start thinking about moving here. And I did start thinking about moving there. But it wasn't long before I found out what happened behind the scenes. The two pastors later told me that the committee's recommendation came to the church council for approval, and one of the elders asked, why is this guy 36 and still single? What's wrong with him? Is he gay? And then once the question was raised, others started saying, well, if he comes here and we discover he's gay, we're leaving the church. Once the pastors heard that, they felt like they couldn't, well, they felt like they had to say something. So they did, and what happened is that the council then decided they didn't want me. The secretary of the council reported their decision in a long letter with this summary line, some of us would love to have seen you come. Others were sickened by the thought. Yeah, that's how I felt. I was still reeling from this letter when letters arrived from two of the church's elders. Both elders apologized profusely for how the council had treated me, and they both reported that they thought a majority of the council and a majority of the church would have been happy to have had me there on the church staff. But the majority was scared off by the minority that was threatening to leave, or that would have threatened to leave. Well, some of them were already on the council. Those letters provided me with a kind of aha moment. I realized that if I were going to be honest about my being gay, I would never get a church staff position in the CRC. And I knew that I was not going to play the hiding game anymore. That game had been destroying me. So for the sake of my integrity and my health, I had to be truthful. This experience provided the catalyst I needed to give up my search for a church staff position and instead follow a call from God to begin a new ministry that would provide support for gay people in the church and education for the larger Christian community about its own gay members. When I turned to a number of CRC pastors and lay members for input, they confirmed my own inner sense of God's calling and said things like, go for it, Jim. The church has been neglecting this issue for far too long. You can help us. As I had been seeking discernment about my call to a new ministry, I'd spoken to some of the staff at Calvin College, and one of them invited me to give a lecture on being gay in Calvin's annual sexuality series. I took this opportunity to give my public coming out speech, and that was in February of 1992. Since I was the first CRC minister to state publicly that he was gay, the news media noticed. To put it mildly. The following week, the Calvin College Chimes published a front page story about me. 2 months later, during the same week, the Banner and the Grand Rapids Press published a story about me. And it wasn't long before I received many phone calls and letters from gay people and family members who had seen the news and were turning to me for support. In the following months, I worked with a group of people to form a new nonprofit organization called As We Are. Eventually, we had enough money for the board to hire me as a chaplain to provide individual pastoral care, lead support groups, and provide education and advocacy in the larger community. I spoke in local colleges, church adult education classes, youth groups, other venues. I gave interviews to various media. Our support group thrived. And in those first few years, we met at Eastern Avenue CRC. Well, now came the test of my preliminary conclusions, which I had drawn while I was preparing my senior research paper at the seminary. I had concluded that for the church to have an effective ministry with gay people would have to take a new approach that affirmed gay people and gay unions. But was I right? I found out that I was. In fact, I found that gay people had suffered in more ways than I had initially realized as a result of the church's flawed approach. Over the course of the following months and years of ministry, I had the privilege, and continue to have the privilege, of providing pastoral care for hundreds of gay people and their families. Many, like me, had experienced a great deal of anxiety and depression, along with suicidal thoughts. Over the years of my ministry, I heard a number of stories of gay people who took their own lives. I found that the rejection that gay people endured led to various other forms of suffering and destruction as well, including tension among family members, alienation from church and God, alcohol and drug abuse, risky sexual behavior, HIV infection, and early death by AIDS complications, and marriages of gay people to persons of the opposite sex, marriages which usually ended in divorce. So a large portion of my ministry in those years was one of providing a safe and affirming environment, both in support groups and individual pastoral care, for gay people who were really struggling. It was an opportunity for them to talk openly and honestly about the suffering that they and we endured. Together, we also reflected on God's love for us as we are, and we learned how to believe and embrace God's love for us. And guess what? People got healthy. Their shame, anxiety, depression, fear, and isolation faded away. Those who had engaged in self-destructive behavior found ways out of such behavior into healthy ways of living. Those who felt hurt by God started discovering the love and peace of God. I saw reconciliation within families as gay people came out and parents and families learned how to love their own gay kids. I found gay people forming healthy life partnerships and making life commitments to each other. And I saw a few local pastors and churches begin to genuinely welcome gay people, including gay couples, into their faith communities. In summary, I found that as long as gay people continued to believe the church's traditional teaching, they stayed miserable. But when they let go of the church's traditional teaching, they became healthy. The church's traditional teaching bore bad fruit, whereas the new approach bore really beautiful, good fruit. And I found myself wanting to say to the leaders of the church, like, how do you make sense out of this? That something that is supposedly from God is so destructive, but something that is supposedly not from God is so good for people, so healthy, so life-giving. And that's still a question I have for the leaders of the church. Well, now here we are, at part two, and this part's very short. And this is 20 years ago. What exactly happened 20 years ago? And this is a very short version. Again, read my blog. Well, what was happening with my relationship to the CRC during those initial years of my LGBT ministry was that I was active, was an active member at Eastern Avenue CRC. Our support groups met in the church, and the church even elected me as an elder. Meanwhile, Classes Grand Rapids East extended my credentials year after year as I built the LGBT ministry and looked for a church that would officially call me to this ministry. As many of you know, the way it works in the CRC is that in order to be first ordained and then to keep your ordination, you need to have a call by a local congregation to a recognized ministry. To make a very long story short, I could not find any church that would call me to my LGBT ministry. And the key sticking point was that I believed, and said I believed, that God honors faithful, loving partnerships of gay couples. So in May of 1998, Classes Grand Rapids East basically said to me, "Time's up, Jim. We've been extending your credentials for 9 years. No church has called you, and it's simply our job to follow church order." So the classes voted to release me from the ordained ministry. I always put "release" in quotes. Because, you know, you release people from captivity. You release people from prison. It's such an odd term. I didn't feel I felt kicked out. And it was exceedingly painful. Afterwards, many people said to me, "Jim, you must have seen it coming." I could honestly say I didn't. I genuinely believed that the church would do the right thing. And when it didn't, I felt deeply betrayed. Now, part three, 20 years later. Well, now here we are, 20 years later. What's happened since 1998, and how am I doing? Well, 20 years ago, I felt really hurt. I felt as though my spiritual family sent me into exile. But you know what? 20 years later, I look back, and I see that God has been really good to me in exile. I have a wonderful life. I actually have an amazing life. Sometimes I think about my life and I think it's like almost magical. It's that good. And I am immensely grateful to God. First, I'm grateful personally. I'm grateful for a loving, supportive family and loving, supportive friends. I'm grateful for two adorable godsons and their families. I am grateful for the last 11 years, I've had a beautiful home in the Newbury Place co-housing community, which I continue to say is like living in heaven on earth. I'm grateful for an excellent Christian education and ongoing opportunities to learn, explore, and grow. I'm grateful for being happy, healthy, and active. I am grateful that God has given me the gift of being able to see the world with childlike awe and wonder. I'm grateful for the gift of faith. I'm grateful for the closeness I feel to God. I'm grateful that I experience following Jesus as a grand adventure. I am grateful that after a time of healing, I was welcomed into Plymouth United Church of Christ and eventually received my ordained ministerial standing in the CRC. And I still have my ministerial standing in the CRC, and I'm still a member of Plymouth. And you might be surprised to hear that I am also grateful for the gift of being gay. I honestly believe that because of being gay, I am closer to God than I would have been, more compassionate toward people who are experiencing suffering and oppression, and more deeply aware of the expansive, all-embracing love of God. And I often think that I have lived through the most exciting time in history to be gay. I have witnessed and experienced a dramatic transformation in our society from severe oppression to this really marvelous affirmation in many aspects of our society, and I have personally benefited from this shift. I am particularly grateful for living through the change from marriage equality being unimaginable to marriage equality being the law of the land. One of the most thrilling days of my life was Friday, June 26, 2015, when the U.S. Supreme Court announced its decision that marriage for gay couples would be legal across the entire nation. When I was young, I never imagined I would see such a day. It was all the more thrilling because the previous Saturday, I had led a beautiful wedding for two young men, both of whom are Calvin alumni. An hour or so after the Supreme Court's announcement, which I was following on the news even though I was at work at the hospital, I got a call from the couple. I happened to be in the office at the hospital. My cell phone rang, picked it up. "Jim." It was the couple whose wedding I had just led the previous Saturday. They said, "Jim, we're at the courthouse. We're the first in line to apply for a marriage license. We need to say when the legal wedding will be. Can we have it on Monday?" There's a three-day waiting period. So 3 days later, we all held a second wedding for the couple, and this time I got to sign a marriage license for them, which felt stunningly historic. And that leads me to my second area of gratitude. I am grateful professionally. I'm grateful for a meaningful and rewarding career as a pastor, first as a church pastor and then as a chaplain for people who are LGBT, and then also as a chaplain for hospital patients and their families. I'm grateful that in these ministries I've been able to use the gifts God has given me to be a channel of God's peace and compassion. For example, every day that I work in the hospital, I have the great joy and privilege of reassuring people that God is with them, that God loves them, that God will take really good care of them, even as they face illness, injury, or death. And I'm grateful that I have seen the Spirit of God transforming people's lives through my LGBT ministry. I often find myself reflecting on Jesus' inaugural sermon recorded in Luke 4, where Jesus reads from the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." I have not only experienced this work of Jesus freeing me from oppression, but I have also had the privilege of participating in Jesus' healing, freeing work in other people's lives. In the last few years, our society has become much more accepting and affirming of those who are gay. And I have found that most of the gay people that I know now are really happy and healthy. So now most of the LGBT ministry that I do is advocacy work in colleges and churches and leading weddings for gay couples. Now, I'd like to tell you about one of the most memorable of those weddings. Two young women called me up and asked if I would lead a commitment ceremony for them. Now, this was before marriage was legal, so we didn't call it a marriage. We called it a commitment ceremony. When I met with this couple for pre-commitment counseling, I learned that they met each other and fell in love at Calvin College. I also learned that both of their dads are CRC ministers. When we held the ceremony, 7 CRC pastors were present, including 6 family members who were ordained. Both sets of parents participated in the ceremony, giving greetings and blessings. During the reception, I watched the various family members, including the 7 ordained ministers. I watched them as they congratulated the couple with genuine warmth and affection. I thought, wow, this is so beautiful. I wish everyone could see this, the love, the devotion, the support of family and friends. This is the way it could be. This is a glimpse into the future of the church. This is a glimpse into the future of the Christian Reformed Church. And it gave me great hope. So you might be wondering, if my life is so good and if gay people are doing so well, why are we even here tonight? What's the point? Well, as you know, gay people may be doing well, but the CRC as an institution and many other churches like it are not doing so well, particularly in how they treat those of us who are gay. And that reality leads me to 2 closing questions. First, when are you going to welcome me home from exile? Believe it or not, I still love the CRC. As I said at the beginning, you are my people. You are my spiritual home. And there are so many good things about the CRC. One of those things is that the vast majority of Christian Reformed people I know are really loving and affirming toward me and other gay people and are affirming of marriages for gay couples. So I'm wondering, like, why is the institution so far behind its members? So I want to return home from exile. I want to return home from the exile into which the CRC has sent me. How long is that going to take? Second question, and last question, when will you welcome home all of us who are gay? Right now, my heart grieves for how the CRC, again, as an institution, not necessarily its individual members, my heart grieves for how the CRC continues to treat its own gay kids, and gay adults for that matter, In a sense, the CRC sends all of its gay members into exile, even if it's the exile of hiding in plain sight. Fortunately, there are now many people, churches, and other organizations where gay people can find the unconditional love we all need. So to be honest, I'm not terribly worried about gay people. I'm really more concerned about the church's witness in the world. I've learned that the Christian community's traditional teaching about gay people does not make any sense to the vast majority of young people today. The reason is that it does not fit within the larger Christian message of God loving us in Christ and calling us to love others. So young people are turning away from the CRC and other churches, and they are saying, I don't want to be part of a church that won't accept my gay family members and friends. So in conclusion, when is the CRC going to welcome home all of us who are gay? When are you going to welcome us home from exile? I pray that it won't be much longer. Amen. Thank you.
A big thank you to Jim again. Sometimes a story like that could be pretty painful, and Jim has... It's not painful for you. It's such a joy to hear you speak and tell your story and express the love that you still have for the church that exiled you. Thank you, Jim. We have a panel coming up front, and I had the opportunity earlier this week to host them at my house, and we got talking, and a couple times I had to shut them down and say, guys, just hold off, let's wait till Thursday to talk about this stuff. So I'm excited to invite these people up front now. You have next to you in the seats or in your hand quick bios about each one of them. And they've graciously offered to stay in back after we're done for a little bit where there's refreshments and you can, you know, chat with them, ask them questions. We're going to take this opportunity, though, to just kind of listen in, let them have a conversation and hear their thoughts on where this conversation is headed. Thank you. So again, thank you to all these panelists up here. Let me kick things off by asking you this: where is the conversation surrounding inclusion in the CRC, and not just the CRC, but the broader Christian community? Where is that conversation headed? Where do you folks see that headed?
Well, I'm not really going to start answering that question until I get something off my mind and heart to Pastor Jim. While you were talking, I've never fully heard your complete story until this evening, so thank you for your vulnerability with all of us, putting your heart in your hand and giving us that 3D version of it. I can't help but compare your story to Joseph. His family and spiritual community disowned him and put him in exile as well. I believe he was for 22 years, and similar years is going on 20. And still he was persistent and pursued his passion, and he continued to kingdom build even among, the people who were not his people. And wow, when his brothers came to him, I imagine that being, the church, and he didn't have resentment for them. Instead, he wept and wept and wept. I believe it was 7 times. And I don't think those were tears of sorrow. I think those were tears of excitement and just like emotional healing. And I pray that the church comes alongside you and welcomes you back out of exile, because not a single one of God's children should ever be exiled or kept out or disowned when we are inferior and incomplete without you and without every member, because no one is less than. And so I pray that we make it 20 years, and I hope that if you're a CRC member out there, or if you're part of, you're an elder or a deacon or even a pastor, that you reach out to Pastor Jim. And he is not resentful like Joseph. He's still so passionate and on fire for Jesus, and you're needed in this community. So thank you for not being calloused off, but still being so warm.
I just may add to the question rather than answer it. I heard you say, Pastor Jim, that you think that there are far more people in the denomination that would support gayness and gay marriage than not. Why are we not having a conversation then? Why don't we hear from that majority? I try to feel that out in my church. You know, how many are open and inclusive but just never talk about it? Where do you find that group?
I was struck listening as well, and I kept thinking, especially toward the end of your talk, about how Jesus said, be not afraid, be not afraid, be not afraid. And that the beginning and the ongoing conversation around this has to do with addressing fear. For those of us who are maybe gender nonconforming or sexual minorities, to address our own fear, address that poison, find ways to not drink it anymore. For those of us who are members of churches or communities that are less than fully inclusive and celebratory about same-sex partnerships, to be able to ask the question about what is the source of my fear here? What am I really afraid of? What's really at stake? And to be able to create space for addressing that fear. I don't know. I don't have an answer at all. And I have not been in the CRC now for some years. I'm also a member at Plymouth United Church of Christ, and I've been grateful to find a home in the United Church of Christ. But the CRC is where I grew up, and I would love to continue to see all of us in spaces like this address the fear on individual levels and also institutional systemic levels.
Well, I think to address Jim's statement about all these people and then your question, Joe, I mean, to some degree, you have to be very careful. Grand Rapids East is not the Christian Reformed Church in general. Remember that we're caught up here in a broader culture war of a political nature that is deep. And so I think it's very daunting, the prospect of getting the kind of transformation that we're talking about here. As far as how it actually goes in the CRC, I mean, who knows how this is going to go? I think at a local, I keep urging us to really work most of all at a local level, at the local church level. I think the church is at its best and truest when it is local. The further you get away from local, boy, oh boy, I won't complete that sentence. it can really get difficult and even ugly. So I think if you focus on local, I think there are quite a few good things going on in terms of local congregations, local communities, persons feeling welcomed in their local churches. I think denominationally, in the Christian Reformed Church. I mean, who knows what's going to happen there? But I think the traditional way that we sort of address that question is to think, go right away to synod. Well, what's synod going to do? And if you're as old as I am, you remember going through the women in ecclesiastical office battles for decades, and that was where the focus always was. I think this one could be different in that I think that this one may be decided, and I'll just throw out a couple of terms here, and then I'll explain what I mean. At a more judicial level than a legislative level. We know the difference between Congress and the courts, the Supreme Courts. But now, applied to the church, we keep thinking, well, what's synod going to do? What's synod going to do in 2021 with this five-year report they're working on? That's sort of the legislative approach. And we keep waiting for synod. I think the judicial approach on this in the Christian Reformed Church would be, how does the church deal with particular cases? For example, I think my own interpretation of Synod 2016's position is that a church can ordain same-sex married people to office, the offices of elder and deacon. I think it's pastoral advice. They need to take that seriously. And I think that it's possible that a church could make that judgment. I think it's possible that a minister in the CRC could do a same-sex wedding. There's something written in the church order supplement after 2016 that has language that actually in the course of the in terms of the final language that was adopted at Synod, it was very, there was a lot of hedging. But let's say that someone, either a minister does a same-sex wedding, or a church elects a same-sex married person to be an elder or a deacon. And then that gets appealed. Someone in the church appeals it to classes, and classes appeals it to Synod. I think it could be that system of appeals, and then when we finally see what does Synod do when it actually faces a particular situation with people's names on it. And if Synod is consistent with itself, that's really what we faced in 1980 with divorce and remarriage, and that's when Synod said resoundingly, we are not elders. We don't deal with personal situations. That's a local elder matter. And it could be that the judicial approach springs this thing wide open far more quickly than the legislative approach. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, but it feels almost... I've encouraged people to not go to Synod and watch the debate, because it's just so harmful. It's so hurtful. People say such terrible things. And sometimes it's out of ignorance, but it still is. I mean, look at the last line of that letter that you received. Well, now imagine sitting for 6 hours at a synodical assembly where people say that again and again and again. So, I don't know. Those are some of my thoughts about the future of this as far as the CRC.
Dwayne, Bethany, Joel, Jessica, Don, just in case you're wondering who's who, Jim. So, Dwayne, if my son wanted to get married, you're saying I should try to find a CRC pastor to do it. And that's where the change will happen? Or one way, at least, how the change will happen?
Well, I will address it more from the vantage point of a CRC minister. I think for a CRC minister to do a same-sex marriage at this point, it must be out of a clear sense of deep calling, because it's not going to be easy. But I think that will happen sooner rather than later. I think it will happen sooner rather than later. And then the church will have to decide what it's going to do.
I guess I'm less hopeful than you, although I found Jim's presentation hopeful, but I'm afraid that you might be part of your own bubble.
Oh, I am. I'm in a wonderful bubble. I love my bubble. I love the people in my bubble. And I'm very aware of that. Yeah. And I'm going to stay right in my bubble. I like living in a bubble. It's not that I don't ever meet people who are outside my bubble, but no. I spend most of my when I'm choosing to be with people, I choose to be with people in my bubble. Yeah, I realize that.
Well, I sort of hesitate to say what I'm going to say, but I feel like Classis Grand Rapids East isn't where it needs to be. But it is, in a sense, a bubble where I think by far the majority of the CRC is not. And,
I think if you're sitting here asking yourself what you can do, being silent has never helped. You can start with reaching out to someone who is part of the LGBTQIA+ community. If you are asking yourself, do I know anyone from that community? You probably should take a deep breath and ask yourself why you're asking yourself that question. Is it because you've made yourself unapproachable for those people to come up to you and feel comfortable with you? If so, I want to challenge you to reach out graciously, not be yet another toxic person, and just be willing to allow yourself to have a conversation with someone who's different from you. I just know that fear hates proximity, and so if you can keep yourself, I'm a hand talker, sorry, if you can keep yourself this far away from somebody, it's really easy to have those misconceptions of somebody, but as soon as you start to get closer, you see their humanity and you realize, wow, they breathe oxygen. Wow, they have a sense of humor. You'll start to realize that you have far more things in common than you do, that things that divide you or separate you or make you different from each other, but you don't have to share someone's experience to respect their journey.
I would like to add just one thing, even though I've already spoken too much. I speak in a fair number of classes, college classes, Calvin, Hope, Grand Valley, Grand Rapids Community College, and I have been for over 20 years. And I'll tell you, young people today, it doesn't matter where I am, Calvin College, Hope College, which are Christian colleges, but even a good share of the students at Grand Valley and GRCC are Christians. For them, the issue's over. For them, they're like, well, of course we need to welcome our gay friends, and of course, you know, gay people should be able to get married. So I'm convinced that by the time today's college students, including those in the Christian Reformed Church, or in leadership positions in the church, the issue will be over. But the question is, how do we get from here to there?
When I was in high school, Grand Rapids Christian High, I first had the idea that I was going to go to seminary, and I had a theme Bible verse that I always signed with my name on everything, and it was 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 16. And in my translation of the Bible, which was probably the NIV, it said, be joyful always. My middle name is Joy. So I was like, well, that's me. Therefore, it's my verse. And that has continued to bless and haunt me my entire life, this idea about being joyful. I have learned from some queer and people of color activists and friends of mine the idea that being joyful when you're oppressed or marginalized is a radical act. So I'm going to encourage you all in this room, by being here, you're part of being joyfully engaged with this. But I'm going to just encourage you to continue to seek joy around this conversation. If you are a gender nonconforming or sexual minority person, find spaces where you have joy. Find people and communities and opportunities to be engaged, whether it's with animals or plants or humans or wherever it is, to find that joyful space, to continue to find life-giving space so that you're finding that antidote to the poison. And if you are an ally, a family member, continue to find ways to celebrate the joy of all the people in your life. I was so delighted to hear that wedding story. I was weeping over here, and I was glad that I had a moment to gather myself before coming up here. But continue to just love your family members who are gay or lesbian or bi or trans or however they are, maybe somehow other than what is more generally celebrated and honored. On that micro level, you're talking about being local, Duane, and like your family, your neighbor, your kid, your grandkid, your student, your peers at school, that's your local. So find those people and just continue to celebrate yourselves and each other and encourage that joy and keep cultivating it. Be joyful always. 1 Thessalonians 5:16.
So as I'm listening to you all talk, I have a question, and that is, Jim, I hear you referring to living in a bubble, your own personal bubble. Don, you're talking about the bubble of classes, Grand Rapids East. We all live in our own bubble. But let me ask you this. When you look outside of that, when you look in the broader community, whether it's a Christian community or secular community, another kind of community, what have we seen? What can we learn over the last 10 or 15, 20 years that can help move the CRC forward without necessarily having to wait for those in college now to get into leadership positions?
I'm going to speak about that which I know nothing. It's my understanding, and this could be wrong, that the Reformed Church in America, for example, will allow a specific congregation to declare itself to be affirming, or that specific pastors can declare themselves to be affirming. I don't know if that could ever happen in the CRC, but I think that would be great.
I'm looking at Jim because I'm wondering if he can speak to the UCC more. But the United Church of Christ is among you. There are several United Church of Christ congregations in the Grand Rapids area, and as a denomination, it is an open and affirming denomination. We have a congregational polity, which means that every body of the UCC has autonomy. So some live it out in different ways. But as a denomination, there is also a lot of resources, a lot of tools helping particularly churches, bodies of faith, communities of faith, to engage this conversation faithfully. So if you are in a context where it might be helpful for you as a pastor with a group of folks in your church, the United Church of Christ Coalition, I don't know what its current name is. It used to be the Coalition for LGBT Concerns, and now it's something that eliminates the alphabet soup, but I don't remember. It's the Coalition of the United Church of Christ. But there are a lot of resources to help engage this and to encourage folks. The UCC as a denomination has been on the forefront of inclusion. It was the first mainline Protestant denomination to ordain a openly gay person, an open lesbian person, open or a person of color, a woman. Like, it's been on the forefront in a lot of different ways, not just with regard to sexuality and gender. But it gives me a lot of hope. And we still have lots of work to do in the UCC too. We're not utopia. But it does give me a lot of hope that there are a lot of resources. There are people who have gone through this, who are continuing to go through this, and they are amongst you in this community. So,
from what you know, did that happen from grassroots up or from the top down? See, I'm looking for a congregation like Sherman Street.
Doug, would you like to answer? Did that transformation happen grassroots or from the top down?
There's a lot to learn from the Christian Reformed Church's journey on divorce and remarriage. We used to have tremendous stigma against persons who were divorced and their families. And what happened? It changed overnight. That's because every family got one. I think the top down follows my answer is it happens one relationship at a time, and usually when you are finally hit by it yourself, your family, and then that's shared out. And I think that's when people change, and then it moves out from there. And the question is, how long people will wait for institutions to follow along in the 21st century as opposed to before? That's an open question. But I think that transformation, deep personal transformation from condemnation to unconditional acceptance, that's something that shifts inside, that is relational. That's not some polity issue.
I have a practical way of moving the conversation forward that I've observed, and this actually is an example from a Christian Reformed church. A couple of years ago, I was invited to speak at a church in Grand Haven, one of the CRCs in Grand Haven, in their adult ed class after church on Sunday morning. And I told my story and then left half the time, at least, for a conversation. And what happened was incredible, because the folks who were in the adult ed class there started talking about their gay friends and their gay family members, and one right after the other. So it's once one started it, then the others felt free to say it. And by the end of the class, people were coming up to me and saying, "This has never happened before. We didn't know we had permission to talk about this in church." And all it took was one adult ed class where people were given the permission to talk. And then it started realizing, like, I asked, like, how many of you personally know somebody who is gay? Like, every hand went up. And again, they didn't know it about each other, because nobody, they all thought, we can't talk about this in church. So I think just a real practical thing would be, like, what if every... Well, let's just say, starting with Classes Grand Rapids East, what if every congregation in Classes Grand Rapids East provided some venue for those who were just their own members could have this space where they could be free to talk, and then they'd start realizing, well, we're not alone, and then, wow, well, it's that kind of, face-to-face conversation that really transforms people.
Joe, does that apply to what's happening in your church?
What's happening in my church?
For your support group.
Okay. I don't know how I can, if I can define it as formally associated with my church, but we have the church's permission to advertise the church bulletin, that much at least. I appreciate that. Yeah, this is years ago that the support group has been meeting for about 10 years now, and it started just because I found another mother of a gay son at church, and we met together to support each other. And then along the way decided that there probably were other people in the church who could enjoy the kind of support that we were having together. And so, yeah, we were given permission to advertise in the church bulletin, and people came out. And but we don't meet at the church for confidentiality reasons. And it's not at all limited to our church. It's word of mouth, and they brought friends, and a lot of people come for a short time and don't feel the need for it, but they stay on the mailing list. They still get contacts about our meetings and meetings like this. They know what's happening. Others have stayed with us for the whole time. And getting to know, like you urge these people to get to know gay people, and the joy that they bring into one's life. It's just wonderful. And I found that true, meeting together with the friends that meet in my home. They have loved ones that they care a lot about and find joy in, and have just no one else to talk with about that. It's a blessing to me. So I don't know how far that touches the congregation other than seeing it in the bulletin. We've made efforts to influence the congregation through adult ed too. We've told stories of grace from the gay point of view. That was not received terribly well. And we've had speakers come in, but they have had to be balanced by someone speaking the denomination's point of view, too. But it's my goal to educate. I think people need to be educated. And like you say, Duane, I think it starts the grassroots, maybe even not in my church as much as in my home and in my family, how I can influence my children and grandchildren to love.
To kind of piggyback off what Joe was saying, I think when someone tells their story, it kind of paves the way for someone else to tell theirs as well, to speak their truth. And that's the importance of our community staying, even though sometimes this world feels drastically, I can't even put it into words, how cruel, especially the one place where you should be able to go no matter what and feel comforted and loved is the church, is God's house. And that's where people who need that love the most have been booted out. I feel like a lot of congregations, especially the CRC, kind of kills off their wounded instead of embracing them and trying to bring them back to life, coming alongside them as we should. We just tell them either A, you're not welcome here, or we don't say that to their face, but you make them feel so uncomfortable that they just leave and then all the problem's gone. But I think it's important to realize as a church that if you make someone upset because you ordain a gay pastor or you marry two women or you allow kids of two same-sex parents to go to a Christian school and you upset a few people, they probably will go to a different church. If you hurt someone from our community and shame us and tell us that God's love doesn't cover us, that somehow there's something wrong with us, we're a mistake, we won't go to another church. In fact, a lot of our community will leave entirely. And that is heartbreaking to know that people were put on this earth to kingdom build and instead were destroying. And so if that's the goal of the church, is to make people feel so uncomfortable in their skin that it even leads some people to taking their own life, then I think the church needs to get out their drawing board again. And if you're looking for a community... And if you're looking for a community of people who will validate you and love you and listen to your story and share your experience, Joe's support group that her and this other lady have created is a sanctuary. And if you feel alone in here right now and you feel misunderstood, and the place that's supposed to be validating you and loving you and seeing you, your church, is not, Joe's house and other people's homes feel like church. And so please reach out to any member of All One Body or a member on this board, and we will get you on that email list so you're not alone.
I think that another way that change will take place is doing what Jim and Jessica and Bethany are doing this evening, is being willing to be open and out with their stories. I just finished Justin Lee's new book, and he said, stories are what are going to change people's hearts. No one can argue with your story. You can try to convince them with, biblical arguments or something like that, and they can knock you down. But they can't argue with your story. And those personal stories are what I think are really going to affect change. So when you have a venue to tell your story, tell it like these brave people do. Thank you.
I would like to piggyback off that, too. The other night, Jessica, you said that we who are allies are very, very important and may even have more power. So Jessica is gay, Jim is gay, Bethany, I'm not, but I have a son who is. And that can limit my power too, because I say what I say because I have a son who's gay. So those of you who do not have a family member who's gay, but are allies, you have more power than what you realize in your local church, I think, to get it to open up.
So, I'm a little bit floored. I have questions on my mind, and you guys are doing such a good job up there. I hate to even interrupt, but let me ask one final question. And I'm thinking, Don, about what you just said here regarding allies having power. So, Dwayne mentioned earlier that it can sometimes be difficult for pastors in the CRC to step out on a limb, strictly due to denominational views as they're currently constructed. So what steps can allies take to perhaps fill that void that pastors may not feel comfortable? They may feel like their job is threatened. What steps can other allies take to help fill that void of need and counsel and support?
Ask for conversation and education. Push your adult education leader, your elders, or whatever. If the Christian Reformed Church is going to stay unified, we have to talk about this, because if we do this right, we will recognize that we are more together than what we think. We all love Jesus, and so we can learn how to talk about this in a way that brings us together and helps us to love better.
I would also encourage people to find ways to be little beacons of safety. There was a safety pin thing some years ago that people were wearing safety pins to show that they would be safe people. And there's all sorts of little symbols. If you have church name tags, you could put a little rainbow on there or put your pronouns on there. And that opens a doorway for people who are looking for a safe person. They will find you, and they will be grateful for your beacon of hope that you're shining in your little way. So if you have less to risk in terms of a job and ordination, and that's maybe something that's a concern for some, but if that's not your situation and you're potentially willing to be a beacon of hope, I would say shine that little light.
I'd like to say a word of really encouragement to lay people. I'm going to start with a short story. A few years ago, there was a local Christian Reformed pastor who had asked me out for lunch, so he took me out for lunch, and he spent the whole lunch telling me that he totally believed in what I believed, and he totally believed in what I was doing. But he said, "Jim, I've got kids to feed." And I said, "Oh, I don't want your kids to starve." But then he went on. Even as we were leaving the restaurant, he was saying, "But I still feel bad." And then since that time, I've done a lot of thinking and observing, and I thought, I get it. I don't really fault pastors. I fault the institution. The institution puts pastors in a really difficult spot. On the one hand, it says, "We want you to be our leaders," but then it basically threatens them with, their kids starving, or that they're going to lose their position, or they'll never get called again especially on this issue, if they come out, really totally affirming gay people and marriage for gay couples. So pastors are terrified because their jobs are literally on the line. And so what I think that the lay people need to do is just say to their pastors, "Listen, we get it. It's really not fair to you. We've put you in this unfair position. So we're just going to let you sit this one out. We're not going to ask you to be our leaders on this because we put you in a position where you really can't be. And so we're going to take the lead on this. And you can just sit and watch, and we'll provide you with some cover." I think, the pastor who maybe does feel really called to lead a wedding for a gay couple is going to need some cover from they're going to need protection from their church, from their elders. And then feel empowered to take up the leadership on this. And don't rely on the pastors, as we often, feel like we need to do.
Yeah, I'm ambivalent about it. I totally agree with what you're saying. I appreciate that. And it's easy for other people to say to someone, "Well, go ahead and stand on that railroad track. It's okay. It's for a good cause." I agree with that. I think at the same time, we need to, just like we talk about giving each other more courage to do things with one another by talking, I think it will come gradually among pastors, too. I mean, early in the Women in Office debate, very few CRC pastors openly spoke in favor of it. Of women in all the offices. By the time we were right up to the time when it was decided, it was fine to speak in favor of it. Now, this issue is so much more volatile, and not just because of the issue itself, but because of the political climate and the broader cultural war that this has now been drawn into, that the issue for pastors often isn't even that they'll lose their job as much as it's that I've been called to be a pastor to, as much as possible anyway, this whole congregation, and I will simply lose the trust and respect of a third of this congregation if I am as honest with this congregation as a whole as I am with you. I think, generally speaking, pastors are way out ahead of the denomination as a whole on the issue, but it's because of that bind. Having said that, I want to also say, though, that pastors, it doesn't feel very good for an LGBT person to be told by a pastor, "Well, I just can't get involved in this issue. There's too we still have to suffer. Pastors still have to suffer with this issue. And suffer with LGBT plus people and have convictions of justice and inclusion. And there are levels at which you still have to be a preacher of the gospel in ways that sends the right trajectory on this issue. So it's not just like, I don't care about professional football, and I don't care about the gay issue. No, that's not an option for CRC ministers. So I appreciate the cover, but I also don't want to take us, off the hook for continuing to suffer.
That, you know, and it had to be you saying that, Duane, because
you're right.
Yep. So thank you.
Thank you.
And believe me, as one, I've been through this whole thing now. I often question myself about have I done the right thing throughout the years, and I'm still not sure. All you can do is make the best decision you can as each event and situation presents itself, and try to do it with integrity, but I think there is middle ground. The church you referred to that you were at a while, and all this Sunday school class started talking, I think it's the church that I was doing an interim ministry in.
Yeah, I think you're
and,
right.
And the first council meeting that I did, I was there almost 3 years. So it was hardly an interim. But the first council meeting, there was someone who just made an offhand remark that was somewhere between insensitive and homophobic. And there wasn't enough to it for me to just get to go crazy. But I just said, you know, I really don't appreciate that kind of talk, and I'm just going to assume that we're not going to have that kind of conversation when we're meeting as a council. Now, I still got a check. I still fed. Well, I don't have any kids to feed anymore. They didn't kill me, and they also behaved. They respected that. So there's an example of where pastors can do some things.
Thank you.
Join me in thanking everybody up here tonight. There are refreshments in the back if you want to hang around and converse for a little bit. And I know handed out there was some new cards that had information. If you'd like to join All One Body's mailing list, please fill that out and find a board member somewhere, and we'll take those from you. Thank you. Have a great night.